Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're dipping into the archives to replay a conversation which I recorded almost 10 years ago with Reverend Todd Peppercorn, who at the time was serving Messiah Lutheran Church on the north side of Kenosha. Since the recording of this interview, Reverend Peppercorn and his family have moved to Rockland, California, where he now serves as senior pastor at Holy Cross Lutheran Church, and he also serves as chairman of the Board of Regents of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. This is an interview in which Reverend Peppercorn talks about an important book which he wrote called I Trust When Dark My Road, A Lutheran View of Depression. Here is that conversation. On today's program, I'm very, very pleased to welcome Reverend Todd Peppercorn, who serves a congregation on the north side of Kenosha. Can you remind me the name of your congregation?
Sure, Greg. Messiah Lutheran Church on 22nd Avenue.
Messiah Lutheran Church. And Todd Peppercorn is someone that I have known a bit through his wife, Catherine Peppercorn, who is a highly regarded voice teacher here in town and marvelous singer. But I feel like I know Todd Peppercorn much, much better now after having read a booklet which he has written called I Trust When Dark My Road, A Lutheran View of Depression. Pastor Todd Peppercorn is one of not an inconsiderable number of clergy who find themselves battling the effects of depression. And this is something which is not easy to come to grips with for anybody who faces depression. It's one of those diagnoses that is not always easily received, and often it can be really, really hard to know exactly what to do with that. But it is particularly difficult when one is in a particular sort of profession, like a clergyman, where you have this sort of sense of yourself and people view you in a certain way, and to, in a sense, be open and honest about that kind of vulnerability and let's call it brokenness is a really big step that is probably very, very difficult, especially for pastors to take. Todd Peppercorn ultimately was able to do that, and one of the ways in which he's wanting to help others in service professions who might be in the place where he has been is to write this booklet. And so we're going to be talking with Todd Peppercorn today about his story and about the experience of sharing this story, not only with his own congregation and circle of friends and colleagues, but really, in a sense, with the wider world through this booklet again called I Trust When Dark My Road. Todd Peppercorn, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
I so appreciate this opportunity. Maybe we can just get a little bit of very general background from you before we kind of head down the road of this sort of darker journey that has also been part of your life. Tell us a little bit about where you come from originally and maybe a bit about what took you down the road of becoming a pastor.
Sure. I grew up mostly in the greater St. Louis area, St. Charles, Missouri, and grew up loving music, loving history, really spending a lot of time in the arts. Went to college at a little liberal arts school out in Nebraska, where I met my wife, Catherine. You mentioned her earlier. Really, from the time I was in high school, I was intrigued by theology. I loved reading. I was kind of a bookish nerd, essentially. And I loved reading. I loved music. I loved a lot of these things. And that kind of sent me down this path of going into a pre-seminary program. That's what it's called in our church body. And while in college, I studied Greek and Hebrew and did all of these areas that's kind of preparation for pastors. And I also spent a lot of energy in many different areas, choir, photography. I was just very involved on campus, sort of created this mentality of the busier you are, the more stuff you're doing, at least in my mind, I think at the time, I kind of tied that to this is a sign of my own worth. Because I was so busy, because I was doing lots of things, that meant that I must be a good person. That means I'll probably be a good pastor because I do lots of stuff. And that mindset sort of carried me through to seminary, where I was very involved in student government and lots of different aspects there. I worked at the seminary I graduated from for about 3 years as an admissions counselor. And one of the jobs of an admissions counselor is basically to sell the vocation, sell the profession. You're trying to convince people that that being a pastor is a good, noble thing, which of course it is. But that also, in my mind, sort of cemented in me this sense that I always needed to be positive. I always needed to present this face of having it all together. Everything's going to fit in nice little cute boxes, and you can put it all in place. Moved here to Kenosha with my wife Catherine 10 years ago, almost to the day. And so I've served at Messiah since then. That's kind of the backstory, I guess.
The first time in this booklet that you mention, let's say, for instance, the word darkness, one of the kind of terms when you try to describe what it's like to begin to experience clinical depression, you talk about it occurring at some point during college, I think. Mm-hmm. When you reflect on your childhood, was there any hint at all that this was part of you, or did it really not, as far as you can tell, surface until this late in life?
Well, the tricky thing about clinical depression, one of the many tricky things, is that everyone goes through mood swings. Everyone in their life have ups and downs. You can look at periods and say, yeah, that was hard. This was better. And so I certainly had that as a child and in high school, kind of, you know, all of the usual high school hormones and everything else with girlfriends and all that kind of stuff. There was certainly a history in my family of depression and of that kind of mental illness. I didn't know that at the time. My mother suffered from depression until she died, probably the last 10, 15 years of her life, and I never knew it. So I spent a lot of time being really angry at my mom because she was so withdrawn from us. And I can remember quite vividly, Greg, going to visit my parents. My mom had cancer. And going to visit my parents a couple years before she died. She died about 5 years ago. And here we've made this trek halfway across the country. We've done all of this work to bring there so she can see her grandchildren. And we saw her about 45 minutes a day. And, you know, so
and you've driven, I think you said, 10 hours to get there.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Western Iowa, so it's a long way with a bunch of little kids. That's just kind of an insane drive. So I'm thinking, we go all of this way, spend all of this work and energy to go see her, and she spends an hour a day with us or whatever. And I was angry with her. Why would she be so selfish as to spend all of this time up in her room when she could be spending it with her grandchildren? Well, I didn't know. I didn't understand at the time that what was going on was that she was spending every ounce of her energy to be there for an hour and to put on that face, to present herself. This is, you know, here's grandma doing this thing. And then she would go back to her room and she would be exhausted, completely spent over something that that you and I now, we would look at that and say, well, how hard can it be to spend an hour with some kids and with some, you know, with your family? Well, if you're suffering from depression, that kind of interaction can be utterly debilitating. It is almost, it's nearly impossible to describe how difficult something so normal can be.
That's probably in some ways what makes, helps us understand when there's a problem where somebody is depressed versus somebody's down because life isn't going well. Because,
right.
I mean, that's, of course, something all of us experience and in no way is a disorder.
Right.
But when there is this darkness that descends on even sort of the normal moments and even what should be really happy times and affect even though that part of your life, I suppose that's when we start to realize, maybe slowly but surely, there's something that's not right here.
Exactly. I think a part of it too, Greg, is for many of us, we deal with, we respond to situations. If I'm having a difficult time at work, at home, I'm responding to a, sort of a specific set of things going on in my life, and that's quite normal. But when you're starting to deal with clinical depression, what you're finding is that even sort of normal situations become nearly impossible to cope with.
So you have, in your words, during college, you say the darkness that I would come to know later only flashed in and out from time to time. So you were just having these relatively brief episodes. You say the fog came again not long into my first year at seminary. And that's kind of intriguing when we are using terms like darkness and fog to describe. I appreciate sort of the visual element of that. You say at some point, it's particularly in your fourth year at seminary, when you were juggling all these different things that you were already, you've already touched on, including being newly married and student body president and so on, and trying to hold all of this together, you say, looking back, I can see that depression was beginning to become a way of life. I would expend all of my energy on whatever was in front of me, trying to keep all the plates spinning in the air, and every once in a while they would just crash. But I'm very intrigued by that, your choice of words there, that depression was becoming a way of life for you. I mean, it was almost in a sense becoming your new normal.
That's right. I think that for me at that time, what was happening was I was beginning to struggle with depression, although I didn't know it very much. And it just sort of slowly crept in on me that this was normal, that this was the way it was, is that you present this picture to the world of being in control, strong, capable, positive, happy, and you just sort of suppress all of the stuff going on underneath. I think our culture really lends itself to people wearing masks, to people kind of having different masks that they put on at different times based on who they're with. And depression makes it, really forces you to try and put on a mask so that people don't really know what's going on. Because let's face it, words like mental illness, clinical depression, these sort of things, even in our enlightened culture, still carry a stigma. I think that most people, when they hear, well, I have a mental illness, they're going to assume that that means you should go to the funny farm or something to that effect.
Right. I mean, that seems like a desperate step to take to admit that or to attach that term to yourself.
Right.
One of the things you mentioned is that not only when you went to seminary, but even to this very day, I think there. You said there are two seminaries for your church, which is the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. I want to make sure I get this right. Neither LCMS seminary has a campus pastor. I mean, and some of course colleges like Carthage have has a campus pastor, and and to whom both students and faculty, for that matter, could go for help and counseling and so on, and the things for which all the things you derive from a pastor. And apparently your seminary was just not set up there. I mean, the place was probably full of pastors who were teaching.
Of course.
But nobody who exactly had that role, and it seems as though there was nobody you felt comfortable going to with this experience that you were having.
And you know, Greg, that I think is quite common, that there is at schools, seminaries for pastors, is that there is a question of trust. A seminary is a school. That means that the professors are going to give grades, and you are going to be certified as a pastor. So there is a sense, even with men that you love and trust and respect, that you can't tell them everything, because they're going to be the ones that are going to certify you to be a pastor. And so if they believe that you have some weakness, some problem, that might result in your not being certified for ministry. Well, that reinforces this mindset of, I got to keep the guard up. I got to keep a mask on. I can't let people know what's happening. Hmm. And so that's what happens with pastors. And I would venture to say that is exactly the case in many service fields. Nurses, doctors, police officers, military, all of these service fields that have certification process. You're not going to tell the people certifying you if you're concerned that you have problems.
Right. Especially one presumes that this is something you so fervently want to do. It's
exactly.
not it goes beyond just I want to have a job, I think I'll be a pastor, but right. I mean typically somebody feels a calling to that to that vocation, and so in a sense to jeopardize that by being honest about some of these kinds of issues, that's a huge step for somebody to take.
And it is there's just very little in the system that kind of allows for that sort of honesty. It just doesn't.
One of the things you also said in describing the persona you were trying to put on and show to the world, you at one point go beyond calling it a mask, although that's one way to think about it, is this happy, optimistic mask. But at another point you said a way of thinking, an attitude of optimism. As the years went on, that attitude of optimism became an unspoken slogan, the invisible uniform everybody wore. If you weren't optimistic and upbeat, then you were not serving the seminary. I'm fascinated by that terminology of the invisible uniform everybody wore, because I think when we talk about the mask, it seems like what that is about is just, you know, like putting a smile on your face that right. really doesn't reveal your true feelings. But when we talk about a whole uniform, I think that speaks so well to all that you were doing. I mean, the way you were trying to keep yourself busy and the way in which you were trying to fill your life with the kind of stuff that would kind of crowd this other thing away from view.
Yep, that's exactly right, Greg. That sense of a uniform is okay. I'm going to get up. I'm going to put on my coat. I'm not going to let anybody in. And by doing this, I'm going to try and convince myself that there's nothing else going on. I actually think that this is a part of what our culture teaches about Christianity. There's certainly a sense with Christianity in our culture that Christianity is supposed to be either kind of happy, positive, upbeat, or you have the angry conservative. And if you're a Christian, you're either going to be this happy, positive person, or you're going to be the angry conservative. And neither of them really reflects the Christian faith, and the fact that that God uses the weaknesses of our lives to do his work, not masks, not this perception of strength and power.
Hmm.
That fits well.
And I was intrigued by the fact that among the many different theologians and poets and hymn writers that you quote through your book, at one point you quote Martin Luther himself, who in some of what he talked about seems to be, one senses, owning up maybe to some of this in his own life, in
sure.
his own persona.
Sure. I mean, with Luther, it's always dangerous to try and do psychoanalysis for someone who's been dead for 400 years. But certainly there is a sense in much of Luther's writings that that he struggled greatly with. If it wasn't depression, it sure looks a lot like it. And with this sense that the devil wanted him to either lie to himself that everything was fine, or to simply fall into despair because things could not possibly get any better. And so there are, I believe, there are spiritual elements to that. There are kind of theological parts to that. But there's also some real physiological, biological things going on. I mean, and that for a Christian, I think that's a part of the challenge that depression, that's a part of the challenge that I have as a Christian, is that there are all of these spiritual elements going on that the devil does seek to try and drive the Christian to despair and away from Christ and away from his healing forgiveness. But at the same time, there are these very real physiological causes to depression. I mean, it is a chemical imbalance. So how do those two things mix together, and how do I understand them, is not easy to do.
Right. So that's another complicating factor, yep, in a sense. And someone not coming from that place at all, it's still a complicated thing to unravel. I mean,
right,
just depression itself, just right, taken as a biological experience.
Right.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Todd Peppercorn, who is a pastor here in Kenosha at Messiah Lutheran Church on the north side of Kenosha. He is somebody who, from college age, has struggled with the presence of depression in his life. And he has written a booklet about that, which not only tells his own story, but is designed to be a kind of outreach to perhaps other clergy who might be facing these same sorts of struggles, because as we've already touched on, this is hard for anybody to admit that they are suffering from something like clinical depression. But also, if somebody is a pastor, the kind of person that we tend to put up on pedestals or view a certain way, this can be particularly difficult. So you take up this first and still only parish call for yourself to Messiah Lutheran here in Kenosha, as in your words, you know, the typical young pastor who feels like he's going to change the world. But it really doesn't take too long before some of these forces start to really bear down on you. That is, this depression within you. You say one of the first things that went away, or I mean, that you couldn't really manage anymore, where this really manifested itself most directly, were in personal interactions. Tell us what kind of personal interactions suffered in the early stages of this depression.
Sure. One of the things that pastors do very often is make calls, hospital calls, shut-in calls, people that are homebound, and as well as sort of emergency cases of special counseling, this sort of thing, and those calls are in many ways joyful, wonderful times. I mean, this is a great opportunity to sit and visit, to pray with people, to hear the trials that they're having, to pray for them. They are also very emotionally taxing, because so often, especially when you're talking about the homebound, they may not have very many people interacting with them. Family moves away. You may be the only person that they actually physically see in a week or a month in some cases. And so those sort of visits, where you're receiving all of the complaints, all of the troubles, all of the heartaches that another person is having, for someone who's clinically depressed, those kind of visits are absolutely debilitating. I can remember quite vividly going to visit someone at Washington Manor over not far from us here, and going over, sort of psyching myself up to go visit this person, and driving there, getting in the parking lot, and being paralyzed. I could not get out of my car. I sat there for half an hour, trying to talk myself into going in and seeing this person. Now, to the outsider, you kind of look at that and think, well, that's crazy. I mean, you're just going to talk to somebody. How much work can that be? Hmm. Well, I think that we forget how emotionally draining those sort of interactions can be. And if you're suffering from depression where outside stimulus, conflict, all of these sort of things are going to be magnified 100-fold, those sort of simple things become major issues.
Hmm. You write at one point, my compassion and ability to bear others' burdens diminished. And I guess that's the part of the thing that's going here, too, is that as you visit these people you cared about and cared about the things that were hurting them or the loneliness they were experiencing, whatever it might be, I mean, right. It's not just sitting there absentmindedly listening to Aunt Mabel prattle on.
Right.
But I mean, if you really love Aunt Mabel and really want to do something to help her, I mean, then we can start to understand the emotional weight that is involved in that kind of interaction. And someone like yourself in your field is called upon to do that nearly on a daily basis, sometimes all day long.
That's
one
right.
after another.
That's right. Psychologists will call that process compassion fatigue. The sense that if you are in a situation, say for example, if you were on a crisis management team for an airport, where you go to, you know, an airport has a plane crash, and you go as a counselor to try and help debrief people after being on a plane wreck. It is absolutely normal that the counselors in a situation like that, within a day of actually having the counseling debriefing, will experience the same trauma that the people that were on the airplane did. Hmm. And that's compassion fatigue. It just transfers right over to you. And that fits with pastors, that certainly fits with nurses, with doctors, with so many teachers, so many different service fields, mothers, where you're taking all of this in and eventually there's just no more to give.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that is there and it is very real.
You write of how other aspects of your pastoral work were compromised by the encroachment of this depression, which was getting worse and worse. And, of course, it ultimately, it's no surprise, also begins to affect the relationship you had with your wife and with your children.
Sorry.
One of the most intriguing things you say in the book is that, your wife Catherine sensed something was wrong and tried to help you in ways, the best ways she knew how, but sometimes in ways it wasn't easy to help you. You didn't make it easy to be helped.
No.
And you said, actually, in some respects, your children were even more perceptive in terms of sort of knowing what was wrong or sensing what was wrong. Tell us the way in which your children were especially perceptive about all this.
Children just have an amazing way of being a megaphone for everything that goes on in a family. You know, children can perceive stress faster than anything else. And so
they're like the canary in the mine shaft, maybe.
Exactly. That is exactly right. And so when I was getting through this period where outside stimulation was hard, one of the hardest things for me to do was play with my kids. Hmm. It just was completely exhausting. The noise, the loudness, the rough houses. We have four children. We had three at that time, and they're kids, and they're wonderful. But they could tell that Papa was holding back, that I would get irritable, I would get angry with them for no reason. They're not doing anything wrong. They're just being kids, and so they could tell probably faster than I could when I was having a good day or a bad day just by how I talked to them.
Yeah, you said that. I mean, one of their favorite things to do with you was to play chase. and that in many respects, as good a benchmark as anything about if you were having a good day or a bad day with your depression was whether or not you were capable of playing chase with your children. And do I remember correctly, there was a period of 365 days, I mean a full year at one point, where not once were you able to play chase with your children.
Yeah, that's pretty close. I actually got to the point with my depression where I was on clinical disability for about a year. And during that period, it was, I really spent very little time with my children, which of course also made me feel terribly guilty. Guilty for not being a good father, guilty for not kind of pulling my weight with the family. All of that just kind of piles on. And yet at the same time, if I had a broken leg, no one would expect me to do my job mowing the lawn. Mm. But if you have a broken mind, if there's a mental issue going on, that's very difficult to kind of understand what that means and how does that affect your life and how that works. So yeah, that was a tough period, that's for sure.
At one point in the booklet, we are shown an entry from your blog journal, which is during this year of where it's become so bad that you're on disability. You write about skipping the fireworks. I mean, that's the kind of thing that once upon a time you would have enjoyed, no questions asked, and now that's absolutely beyond your capabilities. Yep. to put yourself in a crowd like that and to experience that. Did journaling and or blogging provide any comfort or solace to you?
You know, I am by nature a communicator. That's what I do. I preach, I teach, I talk. And so when I was really in the darkest period of my depression, I felt like my personality was being stolen from me. I've always been an outgoing, kind of gregarious sort of person. And so I was really pretty desperate to try and find some way, some little kind of string to connect to what I knew as Todd. And one of the ways that I did that was blogging. I started a blog, darkmyroad.org. I still write on it pretty regularly. Mm. And that blog allowed me to just chronicle what was going on with these situations. The fireworks one was a good example. I can remember another one where I got up to preach a sermon, and I couldn't. I looked at the words. I could see each individual word, but my brain would not put two words together to make a sentence. I couldn't even read it. Mm. And so that blog actually really helped me to sort of externalize what's going on. I think that's one of the important steps for someone struggling with depression, is to think through a way of getting outside yourself a little bit, so that you can look at these things that are happening to you, how you're interacting with your family, your work, your colleagues, whatever. Obviously, a blog may not be right. It may be a journal, maybe talking to a friend, but by externalizing it, by either verbally or writing it, that does allow you to kind of get some ownership over what's happening. Hmm. And then maybe recognize the signs earlier when if you're going down a difficult path. Hmm. So that's how it worked for me, and it was really tremendously helpful to me.
One of the biggest steps you took was to pick up the phone and call a psychologist in the area to whom you had referred people, and suddenly things are entirely flipped, and in a sense you're referring yourself to this person's care. And you talk of how long it took for you to sort of scrape up the guts.
Yep.
To finally pick up the phone and to call this person. And in a sense that began what was still an arduous process of trying to kind of climb back from the pit. A lot of difficult things ensued from that point on. In particular, the whole matter of medication proved to be a very, very rocky road. It's important that people realize that although it can make a difference for the better, it's not an uncomplicated process.
Those two things kind of wed together. Calling a psychologist and then going on antidepressants were huge things for me. We put a lot of identity into some things. We can make kind of a social construction, taking a pill, as making that kind of a mark of something bigger than it really is. And so for me, taking antidepressants in my mind was a sign of failure. If I'm taking antidepressants, that means that I couldn't do it myself, that I couldn't fix this problem. Same thing with going to a psychologist. Why should a pastor have to go to a psychologist? I mean, surely I should be able to – don't I have some sort of direct line to God to be able to fix this myself? And yet that's not how God works. God works through lots of different agencies, different people. He works through doctors. He works through nurses. He works through psychologists, friends, pastors, counselors, and all of these things kind of work together. I like to talk of it as a team, that there is this team of people that God used to bring about my healing.
You also talk about the importance of someone having a team with whom you can have complete trust and who you know care about you on this kind of a level. I mean, to be your advocate and to really assist you as decisions have to be made and that kind of thing, to really help kind of walk you through this. It's not something that one wants to do alone. That's for sure.
You know, Greg, I think that one of the hardest things for people suffering from clinical depression is that you're sort of forced to make all kinds of decisions that are big decisions, but that in your mind are probably even bigger than they really are. Taking an antidepressant is a decision. Yes, there are potential dangers, but there is lots and lots of solid evidence that this is a good, safe, best way to treat clinical depression. But in your mind, if you're kind of going through this, just the process of making that decision can be nearly impossible. That's why it's so important to have these people whom you trust that you can work with to try and make these decisions together.
Something else that ultimately made a gigantic difference for you is tied up in the whole matter of burden of responsibility. And, of course, you've already talked about the persona you had taken on as a pastor, you know, the super pastor who can do everything and the rock of Gibraltar and so on. And in a sense, one of the things that evidently made the biggest difference was not only when you went on this partial disability leave, but ultimately when you gave up certain things you hadn't given up at the start of that disability leave. I mean, it really made a difference for you to shed the kind of responsibilities that were bearing down on you in a counterproductive way. And in particular, when you finally, eventually, actually went away for, I think it was a period of 2 weeks, where you had absolutely no responsibilities whatsoever. I'm sure for someone like you, your personality type and so on, that had to be a really hard thing to do or a big step to take. And yet it probably made as big a difference as anything else in your long road to recovery.
Yeah, Greg, that was a big thing, because when I just to give you a little bit of a sense of this timeline, in January of 2006, I started taking antidepressants and I started meeting with my counselor. In March of 2006, I went on partial disability. In April of 2006, I was told by my doctor, or not by the doctor, but rather by my insurance company, that they'd, through some fluke of paperwork, determined that I was better and that I wasn't going to go on disability anymore. That sent me into a near suicidal tailspin. And it wasn't until that event happened where, talking with my doctor, talking with my counselor, we decided either I had to completely get away from everything, my family, my church, everything, or I was going in the hospital. I chose to go and stay with some friends that were very, very gracious and let me do that. Actually, going on disability, I'm certain, saved my life. That was a great thing. A lot of times you hear something like disability, and what kind of images does that evoke for people? Well, that evokes some kind of sense of failure. Mm. That's not a failure. That was a great gift. What a wonderful thing to be able to be free to heal. Mm. And I think that perception of how these things work are so important to understand.
Well, it ultimately made it possible for you to serve your parishioners again in a way that had been impossible before. I mean, if ultimately what matters the most is their needs and you being an instrument to minister to their needs, if that's what's ultimately really important to you, then anything that makes it possible for you to do the good things you wanted to be doing for them, is a good thing in and of itself, even if it's this drastic step.
And, you know, I should say, Greg, that that there were a couple things too that played into that. First of all, I have a tremendously understanding congregation, wonderful congregation. That this was a crazy, strange road to go down, and they went down this road with me, and they never talked about saying, well, let's try and get another pastor or something like that. They were there. What a blessing that was and is still. But as a result of this, kind of looking at it, coming out from the other side, it's helped me to understand the communal nature of the church, that there are no lone rangers in the church. We're not alone. We're never alone. God uses all of these different people to do his work. And once you get into the mindset of thinking, well, I got to do it myself. Well, first of all, you're sounding a little bit like a 2-year-old. and also, you're saying God can't use all these other people. Hmm. And he does.
We just have about a minute or so left for a fairly profound question, I'm afraid. But you already started to answer it, I think. You say it towards the end of the booklet. First of all, you point out that it is not that depression has vanished altogether from your life.
Sure.
I mean, this remains some presence in your life, but something with which you are able to live so much better and you're able to work within it so much more effectively. And you actually say that in some respects you believe you are a better pastor having experienced that. And the fact that depression, even now to some extent, to a lesser extent, remains a part of your life, makes you a better pastor. What would be a couple of most important ways?
Well, certainly the chief way, Greg, is recognizing that that God works through weakness. He doesn't he doesn't work through that kind of a mask or trying to put on a show. God works through real people, real situations, and real trials and hardships. Really, this has given me a sense of being able to look at my congregation and try to see things more from their perspective. That even, you know, I may look at someone's illness and think on my own, well, you know, that's not that big a deal. They're going to get better. Well, you know, sometimes having an MRI is a really terrifying experience. It doesn't have to be rational. Hmm. And so that sense has given me a sympathy that I believe that is tremendously important. Hmm. So that's it.
I understand that this booklet has been distributed free of charge to all kinds of people, including lots and lots of your colleagues.
That's right.
Probably both within and maybe even outside of your own church, your own denomination, who find themselves in this same situation. And it has proven to be, I'm sure, a great help to many. And the book is available if people go to your website, darkmyroad.org, or you could call Messiah Lutheran at 551-8182, where there are some copies available. Again, the book is called I Trust When Dark My Road, A Lutheran View of Depression. We should probably say I don't think one needs to be a Lutheran to read this book and derive help from it. And and one needs not not need not be a pastor either, because this speaks to a lot of different people in a lot of different vocations. And again, the author, Reverend Todd Peppercorn, the pastor at Messiah Lutheran Church here in Kenosha, I am so glad we could have this conversation today. We wish you well in all that is ahead for you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Once again, this interview with Reverend Todd Peppercorn is from the Morning Show archives. It was recorded approximately 10 years ago. At the time, Reverend Peppercorn was serving Messiah Lutheran Church on the north side of Kenosha. Since 2011, Reverend Peppercorn has been senior pastor at Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Rockland, California, and also serving as chairman of the Board of Regents of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. My thanks to Reverend Peppercorn once again for joining me today on the morning show to tell his very powerful and poignant story. Tomorrow on the morning show, an interview which I am scheduled to record later today with Victoria Phillips, the author of a very intriguing new book called Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. You may or may not recognize the name of Martha Graham as one of the most important dancers and choreographers of the 20th century. Aaron Copland's well-known work, Appalachian Spring, is subtitled Ballet for Martha. It was composed for her and for her dance troupe. What is not widely known to the general public is that Martha Graham, for many, many years, worked in close cooperation with the U.S. State Department and was sent all over the world, especially during the years of the Cold War. And Victoria Phillips's new book is about that facet of Martha Graham's important career. It's a fascinating story. On Monday, we'll be observing an unhappy anniversary, namely the heat wave of 1995, 25 years ago, in the city of Chicago, the worst in the city's history. By the time that week-long heat wave was over, in which temperatures were over 100, more than 700 people are believed to have died in and around Chicago. It raised a lot of important questions, especially about why certain neighborhoods and certain demographics experienced especially high mortality rates. Eric Kleinenberg wrote the definitive book about that human disaster called Heat Wave. And on Monday's morning show, I'm going to be replaying it. Next week's morning show schedule will also include a conversation with the author of a book called White Christian Privilege. Kiathi Joshi is the author of that book. And next Wednesday, we'll hear from Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. Next Friday, we'll include the monthly visit of Nan Calvert to the morning show. We remind you that the morning show is broadcast Monday through Friday, and the morning show can also be heard 7 days a week if you subscribe to the Morning Show podcast. It is available on all of the standard podcast providers, including Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. Empowering